Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, Total Tutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, Neil Haley. And it's amazing how you make connections on LinkedIn, and you talk to such unbelievable athletes, remembering them growing up. And when I think of the Dallas Cowboys, I think of two quarterbacks. One's Roger Staubach, and the other one is the guest I have today. He's a former All-Pro, Super Bowl champion. We're going to learn about his career with the Cowboys and also what he is doing now. So I want to welcome to the program Danny White. Danny, how are you? And thanks for calling.
Hey, Neil, I'm great. I'm just good as I can be, and happy to be with you.
Well, absolutely. I think that when you think about your career and thinking about becoming a Cowboy, that must have been an unbelievable highlight in your career, wasn't it, to be part of America's team?
Well, you know, it really was. My whole football career, you know, growing up as a baseball player, I only played 1 year of high school football, and then went to Arizona State on a baseball scholarship and ended up because of a number of reasons, really being the starter there. And we had just a great offensive team at ASU and then got drafted by the Cowboys. And growing up in Arizona, you know, the Cowboys were our team. That was the team that we saw every Sunday on TV. And so to grow up as a skinny baseball player and end up being the quarterback for America's team was quite a leap, and I don't know that anybody could have predicted it.
So it's kind of like so baseball was where you wanted to go, Danny. It sounds like that's where.
Yeah. No, it really was. I played in two college World Series at ASU, but you know, I got to the point where, you know, I had to choose between playing quarterback for a Division I college football team or standing out in center field waiting for someone to hit me a ball. And you know, there just wasn't any comparison. I mean, the excitement, and this was my hometown team. My dad and I, you know, went to every ASU football team when I was growing up. My dad played at ASU, and so there were a lot of connections there. And it just seems like football just was in the stars. They just lined up for me. And my baseball career was okay, but nothing spectacular. And football, my football life just took off.
And definitely sounds like it. And then playing at ASU in football and then having your number retired must have been an honor as well to be.
Well, it was. My dad and I, for a long time, my dad and I were two of the three players at ASU with their numbers retired and who were in the Hall of Fame. So our family pretty much dominated that part of the ASU football, although there were a lot of great, you know, I think back in the days when I was growing up, Curly Culp and J.D. Hill and Ron Pritchard and, you know, guys like that, Art Malone, and, you know, guys that played for ASU in those days were my heroes.
Definitely. And so then you get drafted by the Cowboys, and then you see who you're going to play behind, a legend in Roger Staubach. And so,
well, yeah. Yeah, not only Roger, but Craig Morton was there at the time also, and which really, really prompted my decision to go play in the World League for 2 years. I could see that I wasn't going to play anytime soon in Dallas, so I went to Memphis in the World Football League and played 2 years there with Larry Zonka and Jim Kick, Paul Warfield. Learned just a ton from Paul Warfield. You know, what a great worker and a great guy he was for me. And so that was a little bit of a stepping stone. And then when I joined the Cowboys in 1976, it was me and Roger and Clint Longley. And that got taken care of at training camp 1 year when Clint and Roger got in a fight. And then after that, it was just me and Roger. So the timing worked out well. I backed up Roger for 4 years. And, you know, people keep trying to put pressure on me, or you know, following Roger, but you know, I couldn't have paid for a college degree, you know, for 4 years and gotten as much out of it as I got from watching Roger and learning from him, and not just as a quarterback, but you know, as a human being and as a professional, and the way he handled himself and his priorities. And it was just a great, great example for me.
I completely agree. And I think that a lot of times you don't have a situation where, I guess, because you and Roger must have got along, you said that the issue with Longley and everything, that it just worked out perfectly for you to to now be in that backup role and learn from such a winner, such a unbelievable athlete, a leader. And I think leadership was one of the probably biggest keys that you learned from Roger, especially from, you know, him being a graduate from the Naval Academy and all of these different things, that leadership was something that probably he taught you off the field as well as on, I think.
No question about it. And it was a very unique relationship that Roger and I had. We had very similar beliefs and all that, yet we were fierce competitors. And Roger, one of the things that Roger did for me was he always made me feel like I was pushing him. He always made me feel like I was actually competing with him. I didn't expect to replace him or to beat him out or anything like that. And yet Roger constantly encouraged me to compete him. And it didn't matter whether we were playing ping pong at training camp, where I don't think he realized that I was a pretty good ping pong player. And when I beat him, Roger wasn't used to getting beat, you know.
Right, right.
And then he's such a competitor, you know, he threw his ping pong paddle into the next room through the wall.
Oh my.
And so that's the kind of competitor. I mean, that was one of my first experiences with Roger. And then whether it was playing basketball or tennis or lifting weights, you know, I bench pressed 305 pounds one day, and Roger, just to beat me, put a 305 pounds on the bar and then put a paper cup on one end just so he could beat me by a paper cup. You know, I mean, these are experiences that we had and the memories that I have of Roger. And yet, you know, when it was all said and done, I think we both had great respect for each other. And I hope I did push him. I hope he was a better quarterback. Because of something that I did, or, you know, at least that I was there. And you know, when I did have a chance to replace him, if he got injured or something, I think, you know, I played pretty well. And we had a great team around us. So anybody that played quarterback for the Cowboys in those days was probably going to play pretty well. But there was no question about it that Roger was the leader of that team.
There goes the how much of a humble person you are. You look at your numbers. Your numbers are, I don't know what you're ranked, a Dallas Cowboy quarterbacks, but once you took on the role after Roger, you left off just where he was going, in the same direction, just did not win that championships, but you were winning and with the Cowboys and everything, and you kept that same core unit together and just kept rolling, didn't you? For sure.
Yeah, we didn't really miss a step. We went to three NFC championship games my first 3 years as the starter. We lost them all. We never could get to the Super Bowl. But as far as numbers go and statistics, I held my own, you know, against Roger and beat most of his records. But the game was also evolving. You know, I had a great team that I had inherited. But as the game evolved, and now you see Tony Romo, of course, shattering everybody's records. And a lot of it has to do with the way the passing game has changed and the way coaches are teaching quarterbacks to avoid interceptions and to throw touchdown passes and to move the ball down the field, throwing the ball. It's a completely different game in that respect than it was when I played, and especially when Roger played.
Definitely, but I consider you the Cowboy quarterbacks. You have Romo, you have Troy Aikman, you have Roger Staubach, and then it's you. And pretty much that, you know, I and ultimately, if you would have won Super Bowls, you would have been considered in that crew of Aikman and Staubach, really, for sure.
I think you're right. Fairly or unfairly, that's just kind of the benchmark for quarterbacks is how many Super Bowls did you win? And yet there are very, very average Super Bowl quarterbacks that won Super Bowls. And by the same token, there are some great quarterbacks. And I think of Dan Marino, and I think of Fran Tarkenton, and I think of Archie Manning. I think of some great quarterbacks who never played in a Super Bowl, who never won a Super Bowl.
Right.
And so it can't be, you know, the only measuring stick, but it's a big one. And if, you know, I don't think he'll ever be considered. You know, I think people look at Joe Montana, and a lot of that has to do with the number of Super Bowls that he played in and won. And yet, the irony of that, Neil, is that the quarterback position, by nature, is the most dependent position of any position in any team sport.
Right.
When you think about it, there's not another, you cannot name another position in a team sport that relies more on the people around him. I mean, if you don't have the protection, if you don't have receivers that get separation, if you don't have running backs that can run the ball and gain yardage on the ground, if you don't have a defense that can get you good field position, especially if you don't have all that, then a quarterback, I don't care who you are, Superman,
right,
can't play quarterback. And I was very fortunate in that I saw both ends of that. My first 3 or 4 years playing quarterback was easy. It really was. And all I had to do was keep my receivers happy, mm-hmm, because I had all the time in the world. And then the last 3 or 4 years of my career, instead of reading the coverages, I was looking at the pass rush, trying to find some place to move to keep from getting hit so that I could throw the ball. And you know, what a difference that makes. And you watch quarterbacks today, and it's the same thing. If they're having to move around and dodge people and to find a place to set their feet to throw the ball, they're not going to have a lot of success. But the guys that get rid of the ball quickly and can set their feet, and you know, I think of Tom Brady and Peyton Manning, those right. guys, you know, they're not throwing the ball on the run a lot. They're
no.
they've got a great system and great
offensive
and the
line.
People
yeah,
around,
right.
yeah, I mean, the people around you are so critical to a quarterback. So when you talk about Super Bowls, you know, a Super Bowl is not ever won by one player, and a quarterback can't possibly win a Super Bowl without all those elements,
right, exactly,
you know, around him. Yeah.
I mean, you think about specifically enough, even losing Super Bowls and consideration. I think that by you being the backup for Roger Staubach, it kind of goes back to the specific fact that if you would have played for another team, had those numbers, and you were the guy for 10 years, you probably would be considered in the numbers of what we've talked about, these other quarterbacks. You know,
well, I think there are a lot of teams that would love to have gone to 3 consecutive championship games, and that would be considered, you know, really positive, good seasons. But, you know, with the benchmark that Roger set and the Cowboys set, anything short of winning a Super Bowl was not going to be acceptable.
All right. So when, as you talked about before, you had those years of backing up. You had to play. You played in another league before the World League. Then finally, when it's time to hang it up, did you have an idea of what you want to do life after football? We talk about this all the time, you know, nowadays with athletes and specifically what to do next. Did you have an idea that you wanted to definitely coach right from that?
I did. I really always felt like I was a coach on the field. I was one of those guys that made a lot of decisions on the field, and Coach Landry, I think, realized that I kind of had a knack for making decisions, and you know, there were some that didn't work, obviously, but most of them did most of the time, and I think you have to have, and then in coaching afterwards, you know, Coach Landry, we had kind of had a plan that I was going to come onto his staff as soon as I retired. Unfortunately, that didn't work out because I retired the same year that Coach Landry got fired. So my coaching career took a little bit of a different turn. But as a coach, you realize that the guy that plays that quarterback position, you know, you want him to listen to you.
Right.
But you don't want to have to tell him everything, because things happen out there on the field while you're standing on the sideline as a coach that you can't predict. And your quarterback is stuck out there by himself, and he's got to make decisions, and he doesn't have time to run over to you and say, "Hey, coach, what do I do?" You know, so you've got to have a guy that's got a lot of confidence in his own ability to make decisions and make them very quickly. And that, to me, is the single biggest trademark of a great quarterback, is his ability to make the right decision,
yes,
given a particular situation. And you have 4 or 5 decisions to make that you can choose from. The guy that can make the right decision the most, the highest percentage of the time, to me, is the greatest quarterback.
I agree. And you know what's interesting is, then you talked about coaching career. A lot of athletes after, and they try to coach, aren't successful. And you kind of landed in the Arena Football League when the Arena Football League really had its beginning. And you are considered, again, a Hall of Famer when it comes to the Arena League. So tell us specifically why that avenue in coaching, to get a head coaching job in the Arena League, you know?
Yeah, that was unique. I had been retired for a couple of years, living in Dallas, working in the real estate business and the oil and gas business, and doing some things just kind of going through that transition, and that's a big deal, Neil. I mean, you look at the struggles that some players have today transitioning from football to real life, and yet it's one that every player has to make because of the short shelf life of a professional football player. But for me, Jerry Colangelo called me, and he had just purchased an arena football team for Phoenix.
Okay.
Of course, growing up here in Arizona in Phoenix, and this, all my family was here, all my wife's family's here, and this was a chance to come home and to get into the coaching business and, you know, to get that start. And so it really was not a very difficult decision for me to make. And those first, you know, 8 or 10 years that the Arena Football League was around were great years. I mean, we had a blast, and we had good players. We paid them a lot of money. And they played a game that, to me, was really a lot of fun, not only to coach and to play, but to watch. And unfortunately, it just never could catch on TV, and the TV ratings never really got going. And so the model kept getting cut back. And finally, it just got to the point where, you know, there just wasn't enough money in it. And but I loved my years of coaching in the Arena Football League.
And having success is another thing. It just continues. You had success in college as a Hall of Fame. I mean, in the Hall of Fame with the, I mean, your numbers retired with Arizona State, then your great years with the Cowboys leading them to 3 NFC championship games, and then winning championships with the Arizona Rattlers and also being named in the Hall of Fame. So you really have had an unbelievable career when it comes to the sport for sure. And, and you got to look at that. Yeah.
It's been a great career, you know, but through it all, and, you know, fortunately, being surrounded by people like Tom Landry and you know, Roger Staubach and a lot of my teammates, you know, fortunately, you know, my priority in life was never football. It was always, you know, my family, my faith, and that
mm-hmm.
has been, you know, now that I'm 63 years old, looking back on it, I am so fortunate that I had that support system, that foundation supporting me. Because I can understand why guys struggle so much and they become alcoholics and drug addicts. And some even commit suicide. I mean, they leave the game of football and they have nothing their whole life
was
the game of football. And fortunately, mine never was. And so it was a great career, and I could not be happier. Nothing I would change. I mean, people say, well, wouldn't you have rather gone to another team and not had to back up Roger and Rod? I said, absolutely not. Absolutely. I wouldn't change a thing play for a coach like Coach Landry
and Roger
and all that,
and it's amazing.
Learn the life lessons that I learned, which are so much more valuable to me now than any winning 10 Super Bowls.
Definitely. You know? Yeah. And then thinking about when you talked about family life and different things, that you, learning the leadership that Roger taught you and Tom Landry taught you led you to today where, you know, your family life and seeing the leadership of a family life and also in business because you're a motivational speaker. And so what are you currently doing, Danny? What are you currently doing?
I do a lot of that. I do a lot of keynote addresses, talk about leadership, talk about failing successfully, which sounds like an oxymoron, but it's not. You know, through life, everybody has failures. And the greatest reason for not succeeding is a fear of failure. Is people just, they don't take a chance. They don't want to push that envelope. They don't ever find the edge of their capabilities because they have such a fear that they might fail. And I talk a lot about that in keynotes and talk to corporations, training on leadership and things like that. And, you know, I've got a ranch in Eastern Arizona. I got 4 kids and 14 grandkids. And so believe me, I've got enough on my plate to keep me busy and keep me happy, and I love it.
Well, exactly. You did everything. Now you're enjoying life, and you're also helping others, and that's the key thing. So, Danny, I know your busy schedule, all the different things, but where's the best place to find information on you? I know you have a website. Is there anything else, Danny?
Just my website, DannyWhite.com. Everything's there, and got some videos on there of some of the highlights of my career and some of the things that I'm doing today, and that's the best place, Neil.
Well, Danny, it's great to hear. You're a definite great leader and very humble in your success. And it goes back to your family life. You understand the importance of family and your faith. And that's the key component in life, and especially life after football, because you only have a short time on the field. But then the rest of your life is to really use your status to help others, because people are going to learn from Danny White and listen to Danny White than somebody across the street because of what you did on the field, because they see who you were and now how you're helping others. So thanks again for calling, Danny, and best of luck to you.
You're welcome, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
All right. I appreciate it. It was an honor. Thank you. Take care. All right. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Yeah, you're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back, the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, Neil Haley. And let the celebrity interviews go on. And it kind of reminds me, we're thinking the 1980s. Think about The Breakfast Club, 16 candles, different things. So, and then the rest of his career talking about Transparent and different things. So I'm excited to welcome to the program celebrity actor John Kapelos. John, thanks for calling, and how are you?
I'm great. How are you? I'm feeling good to speak with you.
Oh, I'm feeling good to speak with you as well, and it's kind of exciting. And when you think about the 80s and your acting career and being in such cult classics that will live on forever, it must be awesome, right?
Yeah, it's a good feeling. It's good that these movies have, you know, survived. I mean, this is what actors want to be, and they want to be in, you know, classic movies.
Yeah, definitely. You want to be in the classic movies that people will say, you know what, I just remember you from that point on, and specific things. When you think of, like, again, you're talking about specifically The Breakfast Club, 16 Candles, Weird Science. I mean, I guarantee college kids today are watching these movies. That's what's so awesome.
Yeah, and they resonate, apparently, right?
They definitely do. So tell us specifically some of the roles you played in them. I know there were certain, you know, different things, like the experience on The Breakfast Club. Tell us about that.
Well, the experience in The Breakfast Club was, you know, I was in New York working off Broadway at Second City. Second City's from Chicago, but we were doing a review at the Village Gate in New York, and this is in 1984. And I had done 16 Candles. I played the oily bohunk, Rudy Rizchek, in that film about a year and a half before. And I had done,
oh, my gosh, that's one of my big favorites, Rudy, for sure. Yeah, that's awesome, yeah.
And when I was doing that movie, John said to me, you know, I got this other movie called The Breakfast Club, and, you know, I would love you to be in it. And I went, great. And then flash ahead, I'm in New York, I'm working off Broadway, I'm picking up the, you know, that big, thick weekly variety paper they used to have, and I pick it up and I see Breakfast Club Lensing, as they say, in Chicago. And then they listed the cast, and playing the part of the janitor, which was the part that John had mentioned to me, was Rick Moranis. So, you know, instantly my heart sank. I thought, man, that ship has sailed. And, you know, closed the paper, forgot about it. Well, literally the next morning, I get a call from my agent in Chicago saying they want you to come into town to do The Breakfast Club. I went, okay, you know, what time and where? And what had happened is that they had started shooting with Rick Moranis, and he wanted to play the character as this Russian immigrant, you know, with teeth, the mouth filled with gold teeth, and
right,
this chain of key chain sort of dangling between his legs that he played with provocatively and with a thick Russian accent. And they shot for 2 days, you know, and John said, didn't you read the script? I mean, this guy went to this high school. He was, you know, the man of the year and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, he was part of this environment. And Rick said, well, I wanted to do it this way. And apparently it wasn't a meeting of the minds. So
right,
I came in, did my thing, and stepped into it. And you know, that's how it goes.
right place, right time, for sure. My two favorite movies, honestly, were 16 Candles and Weird Science. So Breakfast Club was not, I don't know why. I mean, I was born in 1973, John, so I'm 42. But when I think of Weird Science and 16 Candles, even though Breakfast Club did much better, and you had probably working with the actors that you worked with were just so famed, meaning their careers and where they spanned at that time in the 80s, for sure. I mean, thinking.
Yeah, no, and, you know, you take your pick. People have favorites of all of those, and, you know, Weird Science is certainly fun to do, and as with 16 Candles. And they were all, you know, amazing experiences. I was actually in Ferris Bueller, too, but my sequence was all cut out. So I never really made it into the final cut of that movie.
But you got to be on the set of that great movie as well, Ferris Bueller.
Oh, yeah, I was on Ferris Bueller, too, so that was fun.
So now tell me specifically the role as the janitor, because, I mean, I've seen the movie, but for our listeners out there that, hey, they got to go check out all these movies we talked about right now on Netflix and different things, specifically the role of the janitor, what was the storyline in that? And we'll get right into Transparent and stuff like that.
Well, the kids, you know, Molly, Judd, and Emilio and Ali and Michael Hall were all in detention. They're all in Saturday detention.
Yeah, I remember that part, yeah.
Their teacher is Paul Gleason, who plays Vern, the late, great Paul Gleason, as a matter of fact, passed away about 6 years ago. And the action takes place, if you will, on a Saturday when they're all in detention. So, you know, about a third of the way into the movie, this janitor sort of comes in the library where they're cleaning up and takes away a little bit of garbage, and at that moment in time, the smart aleck, Judd Nelson, sort of chimes in and says, you know, hey, man, what's it take to be a janitor? And then all of a sudden sort of prompts a little discussion where the janitor sort of, like, you know, blows them off in a way and says, you know, that clock is 20 minutes fast. And what we see is the janitor's, you know, small but mighty little part in this movie is kind of the, you know, the cynical, sage-like, you know, buzzkill, if you will.
Right.
The guy that sort of tells them where it's at. And if they think they're special, they're not, because, you know, every week there's just a different group of you guys. And, I know what you do. I read your notes. And, you know, I'm kind of the all-seeing eyes and ears of this institution. And, like, he's kind of a leveler, you know. And when we see that little shot of him at the beginning of the movie, before you get into the library, that he was actually a student in the school and was most likely to succeed or man of the year, then you realize, hey, you know, this guy might have had some dreams too, and what happened in his world? I mean, if you sort of think of it subtextually, because, you know, the film was all about, you know, breaking down barriers. So right. Maybe if you come to understand who the janitor is even, then you sort of understand what life is about, that, you know, everybody's got dignity and everybody's got their place and everybody's got an identity behind the sort of identity that we all wear. And I mean, a real human identity beneath the emotional suits we put on, like whether you're the jock or the you know, the pretty girl or whatever, you know, or the janitor or the teacher, whatever role you play, you're a human underneath.
And then when you talk about detention and getting in trouble in detention and having the variety of people with the different cliques and things like that for now, the days of bullying now, John, how that speaks so well to specifically different groups of people getting along finally after being stuck in detention that entire time. That's what really leads to it and looks at our society today and how kids in the cliques, and it's even worse today than it was in the 80s. And I guess it's a really life lesson from watching that movie for sure. Would you say? Yeah.
Well, Kurt Vonnegut said, "You're going to meet everybody in life. You're going to meet everybody in high school that you're going to meet in life, you know." And in a sense, it's kind of the, you know, it's life 101. You know, when you go into high school, you're going to meet all sorts of people, right?
Right.
And I'm glad that personally that I think that bullying is being addressed, because, you know, it's a problem everywhere all the time. You know, I was bullied growing up. There was this guy that used to. Man, he'd chase me every day going to school, and in the winter he'd, you know, wash my face with snow, and, you know, he was a really troubled guy, and I remember seeing him many years later and realized, man, this guy came from a broken home with abusive parents, et cetera, et cetera. So, in a sense, I had more sympathy for him as an adult, but still, this guy was making my life a holy terror when I was a kid.
Damn.
And like, you know, everybody's got stories like that.
Exactly.
And like, nobody likes to be bullied, and even bullies don't like to be bullies, I think. You know, I think in some strange way they need to be liberated from their role. So I think that the thing about John Hughes movies, it's so freaking important, whether it's 16 Candles or Weird Science or Uncle Buck or She's Gotta Have It or whatever, is that there are elements of truth. He speaks to his audience on a level that they understand. He doesn't condescend to them. He doesn't talk down to them. He's really honest and sincere, and I think that, despite the fact that he's sardonic, witty, and, you know, funny, there's a element of the ideas beneath his movies are sound, you know? They're not, people aren't being victimized, people aren't being laughed at, it's not a crude type of humor, which, you know, creates victimization. It's, you know, there are a lot of humor out today, and I'm not going to reference it specifically, is about pointing at the other and making fun of the other. And at the end of the John Hughes movie, you realize, wait a minute, I have a lot in common with that
woman. The other person, yeah.
Yeah, I have a lot more in common with that person than I realized. And it's all about, you know, sort of breaking down barriers and understanding and being compassionate about other people's identities.
Absolutely. You know, definitely.
Good ideas. Even in Weird Science, you know. You know, she has a message for those guys, right? You know?
Right.
And I think that, you know, ultimately we live in a world of ideas, and what people react to in movies, they may not know that they're reacting to. Like, why does this movie resonate, people ask. It's because the ideas are sound, and that they resonate and live, and they make you feel good about yourself, and also serve to educate, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And that
illuminate.
I don't think
without
movies,
you knowing it.
I don't think movies are like that a lot of times, John. The ones that really are successful, but there's so many garbage movies that come out that have no storyline, no substance to it. And these movies were about humor, but also John Hughes taught us much more and about
right.
life.
And, you know,
yeah.
I worked at Second City, and I was trained as an improvisational actor to go up on stage and improvise characters. But when I got off stage, the producers would say, "Okay, why do we want to see that person? Why are you putting that homeless guy on stage?" What, or whatever character I chose to play, whatever I chose to play, but I had to defend it, because at the end of the day, there had to be something, a reason to be for that character. Why am I illuminating the human circumstance through that character? And what am I saying? Because if I'm merely ridiculing a homeless person, then forget it. Nobody wants to see that. But if I'm illuminating the human condition and giving some sympathy to that character and illuminating something in you that might say, "Oh, geez, I'm just like that person," then I've done my job, right?
So basically from that kind of took you off of being recognized in Hollywood. You say those three films, and then from there you were involved with some unbelievable works. I mean, if you look at the Wikipedia and who you've worked with in your career in acting, it's amazing.
I put myself out there as an actor, and I was given opportunities, and I'm still given opportunities. And whenever I can nail those opportunities, you know, I mean, I've worked with Richard Gere and Michelle Pfeiffer and James Woods and Raul Julia, and, you know, up until this day, you know, working with a whole different generation of actors. And it's gratifying, you know, and also exciting, because, you know, how many people get to work with Tom Hanks? You know, I worked with Tom Hanks before he became, you know, iconic,
right.
Academy Award winning Tom Hanks. You know, he was just this guy from Bosom Buddies and Bachelor Party, and everybody rolled their eyes. Oh, yeah, who's this TV actor we're all going to work with? And, man, the day I worked with Tom Hanks, I thought I'd just run a marathon. The guy was just incredibly quick and just brilliant, and I went, oh. He made me realize how much work I had to do. He was so much better than me, and I was humbled by the experience. So to work with great actors also betters your game. It's like if you're a tennis player and you're playing with, Martina Navratilova, She's bound to make your game better, right?
Right. And interviewing great people like yourself makes my game better, because it's easy. I can ask easy questions, and you're not, like, pondering the question. And that's the great thing of interviewing the more interesting people from all different genres as celebrities, for sure.
Now, is that your way of saying I'm over-talking?
No, not at all. No. I'm just joking. I like it because it's a good banter back and forth. So basically, John, the one thing that's very interesting about your career is then the experience on Transparent. And because we could talk about your career, and we don't have enough time for sure. And then I want to go to your current projects. But being part of Transparent and being acclaimed from that really helped you, right? That kind of, I don't know if it was a validation of your career so far, but something to say, hey, now finally I'm in something that, you know what, people are going to remember other roles I had, but to have this where I'm, you know, considered an actor in other roles than just, hey, this was the guy from the 80s. I think Transparent really changed it.
Well, you know, I've never gone away. You know, the thing about the guy from the 80s thing is that, so be it. But the fact of the matter is, you know, I've continued working. And Jill Soloway, for example, is kind of like if you were to say John Hughes incarnate today in some sort of weird, twisted, different dimension, she's definitely an original like John. She has a definite voice, and she's amazingly talented and prolific. So and she's a Chicago person too. So although John Hughes was technically from Detroit originally, but she's amazing. And to be involved in that, she did a movie called Afternoon Delight, and I did that too. And she appreciates the value of what people like myself can bring to the gig. And, you know, as much as I'd like to think I'm, you know, singular in this world, there are lots of really good actors like myself that bring a lot to these gigs, and a lot of veteran actors, you know, that should be appreciated. So just the fact that, you know, she asked me to do the gig was like reason enough for me. I mean, last year too, I did 10 episodes of Justified or 8 episodes of Justified, and, you know, I've been able to, you know, sell my wares elsewhere, but I got to tell you, Jill's work is just, like John Hughes' work is singular, you know?
No, definitely. So you're part of that situation. So what's new with, again, you, John, so far? What's new with you? What are the latest projects you're promoting? And because, you know, you wouldn't be out doing the whole, circuit of interviews and different things, as you talked about when you were in Chicago a day ago doing a bunch of different things. What's new with you?
Well, I mean, actually, I got this great, I sing and I write music, and I've got this album that's coming out called Too Hip for the Room. That, you know, I'm sort of going to combine my talents of performance and add a little singing into the mix. And it's a 14 jazz songs. I covered Don't You Forget About Me. And did you get a copy of it, by the way?
No, I did not. I would like to, definitely. Yeah, I did not get one.
I will.
Yeah.
You shoot Susanna your email.
I will definitely
or Hilda,
do that.
I'll shoot you a copy of the song. But the album that I'm really excited about, it's really, you know, a game changer for me. I want to tour with an 18-piece big band. I'm going to be putting up a Kickstarter for it in May, and I'm releasing the song in April, and the date to be determined. The single will be Don't You Forget About Me. Got a couple different mixes of that, and I've got some of the finest musicians in L.A. working on it, and it's like the album kicks butt. And I've got a movie that I'm going to be that I've written that I'm going to shoot this fall, small budget movie, and the title is something that's under wraps, but it's kind of cool. And I'm developing a show with some people for Amazon at the moment. So
yeah, you're definitely out there still doing what you can. And what the big thing is that you're a working actor. You keep working. If you would look at the roles that John has had, you'd say, wow. And who you've worked with and you continue to work with, and you continue to go on and move on and continue to, change, I don't know if re-transform yourself, but constantly looking for new opportunities and new experiences. That's what it sounds like with you, for sure. You're definitely open to it. Yeah.
And what does an actor do? An actor acts, a writer writes, a singer sings. So you got to go out, as the Greeks like to say, find the trouble, you know. And let's leave Greece aside because they found enough trouble. But there's an old Greek expression, you know, you got to go out and get your fingernails dirty, you know, get involved in life.
So where's the best place to find information on you, John, so we can learn more about you and different things? I know that you have social media, different places to find you, and then also the music, yeah.
I'm on Twitter at John Kapelos. I also have a John Kapelos page on Facebook and a John Kapelos News on Facebook, and we also have a Too Hip for the Room page on Facebook. So all that stuff is out there and available to people, and we'd like you to get on our mailing list and so we can let you know what's going on. So that's where we're at.
Well, John, you're fantastic. You're a fun interview. You're interesting, and I enjoyed learning about specific things. And now I have to go and say, I need to watch Breakfast Club again. I need to watch 16 Candles again, because I say, you know what? What did I ever think when I, you know, as a school teacher and a professional wrestler, didn't tell you that, John, that someday I'd interview people like this that I watched when I was a kid. It's wild. I just interviewed Danny White from the Dallas Cowboys just 15 minutes before this. So look at this, remembering these people and seeing that they were iconic in my lifetime. You know, when I was impressionable, what an amazing thing to get the opportunity to talk to them and hear about their experiences. So that's what I love about my job in the radio and television, is getting to talk to these amazing people and learn from them and learn about what made them tick. And it's interesting. So,
it's lucky to do that. I think that's a great job to have. And frankly, you know, it's fun to speak with you too, because it's always good to be interviewed by people that are enthusiastic and, you know, want to know and do know. So that's kind of cool for me.
Definitely. So thanks for calling, John. Best of luck. We'll stay in touch via social media and stuff. And let me know if you have any projects. Just give me a call. I'll have you on my show, okay?
So I will, and, you know, make sure you get the single and play it, please.
I definitely will. All right, take care, John. Good talking to you, man.
Bye-bye.
All right, see you. All right, you're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, Google Plus, Neil Haley. And I think this guest, the celebrity that probably, again, of celebrities is getting the most times on this program, but she's one of the hardest working women in showbiz for sure. And, you know, from her philanthropic work to specifically her other projects, her one-woman show, and then you look at all these other things that she does, and she's constantly at the awards events and all these different things. So I want to welcome the program celebrity Kat Kramer. Kat, how are you? And on her right, you're just continually busy for sure.
I'm more busy than ever, but it's great. How are you?
Good. I mean, I tell you, that award season was amazing this year. I was really impressed by, you know, the mention of Stanley Kramer to just specifically enough just the, I guess, where the films are going now and barriers and stuff for sure.
Yeah, and in fact, two of my father's films are going to be at Turner Classic Movies Film Festival this coming weekend, Inherit the Wind on Friday morning, and Judgment at Nuremberg on Sunday afternoon. And also, you know, a lot of people we know are going to have films at the festival, so I know we'll be there. There's so much going on, but we definitely will be there for that.
And what do you think of it for our listeners before we get into some of the projects of just going to these award ceremonies and knowing how many people knew your father so well and having these conversations with them? And you might never have gotten the chance in passing in Hollywood to meet them, but then when you get the chance to chat with them, it's amazing, isn't it, to understand the influence your father had?
Well, I mean, people are still talking about Kevin Spacey's acceptance speech at the Golden Globes back in January. And of course, my mom and I were both in the room when he said all those wonderful things. And it was so surprising because we had not expected it. There was not even, I mean, I caught his eye in the room beforehand, but there was no conversation, no, you know, reference points. He just kind of came out of the blue doing it. So, and we thought, oh, no, this meant, you know, when he did it, it was like, oh, wow. And then he kept going and going, and it became the whole focus of the speech. So, and we had so many comments since then, you know. It also creates controversy. Of course, I like that, but my father never shied away from it.
Yeah, well, he definitely, controversy's part of it, and he was groundbreaking in that way, wasn't he, your father?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's why I'm following so much in his footsteps with the screening series, you know, and, you know, I have to share with you that I finally am kicking off the 2015 season. This time I'm going to attempt to do three this year, so I've never done more than two in a year. Mostly I just do one, but I did two in 2011, but I'm getting ready to launch three.
Three films,
and the first one is on April 10th, coming up just right around the corner. And I'm real excited to announce it's the seventh installment, because I had an association with last year, a smaller event, but that was like the sixth installment. This one is Bhopal, A Prayer for Rain. It's an amazing film that actually had a limited release back in November of 2014. And it stars Martin Sheen, Cal Penn, and Misha Barton. And it's directed by Ravi Kumar and produced by Terrence Sweeney. And we have quite a few wonderful people coming. First of all, I'm so honored that Martin Sheen is going to be coming. And then his first time ever to Kat Kramer's films that changed the world. It will be his first time at one of my events. He's on the host committee with Misha Barton. And he's going to be introducing our keynote speaker, Tim Edwards, who's flying in from London, England.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's the executive trustee of the Bhopal Medical Appeal. And I don't know if you know much about what happened, but this is it was just the 30th anniversary of the gas leak in Bhopal, India, which was December 3rd of 1984. And this is a drama that's based on true events leading up to that time when there was a pesticide leak, at Union Carbide India Limited, which, you know, killed thousands of people.
Oh, wow.
and injured thousands in just a few hours. And, you know, the whole thing was hushed up. Nobody ever did anything about it. And Warren Anderson, who was the head of Union Carbide, that's who Martin Sheen plays, he was afraid he would be sued, and he just went there and tried to help, but he just kept his mouth shut, and the whole thing just kept growing and growing as a tragedy. So this film examines the aftermath of what happened, and it's, you know, it's considered as the world's worst industrial disaster. And the victims' families are still fighting this 30 years later. They've never had any justice. So that's what the Bhopal Medical Appeal is about, and we're so lucky to have them, that he's flying in, and he's flying in just for this event. And then I'm having a power panel with a lot of wonderful people on it, including Mr. Sheen, Misha Barton, who plays an important role in the film, Ravi Kumar, the director and co-writer, the executive producers, Terrence Sweeney and Leszek Borinsky, and the director of photography, Charlie Wupperman. And that's my panel, because it's going to actually be at the Canon screening facility. It's actually where I did Fallout. And so we try and, you know, it doesn't have to be Canon, but we try and highlight films that have been shot on Canon, and quite a few of the key scenes in this movie have been. But what I'm even more excited about, not that I'm not excited about that, but at the same event, I'm going to be launching a new award with Kat Kramer's Films That Changed the World.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've always wanted to do it. I've been thinking about it for a couple of years, and I finally came up with the award and the recipient, and it's called the Marsha Hunt for Humanity Award. And I don't know if you know who Marsha Hunt is, but she's 97 years old. She was a big actress, you know, back in the golden age of Hollywood. She first started in 1935 when she was 17 years old. And she was blacklisted. She was one of the Hollywood 10, but that's not why she's getting the award. She'd actually prefer not to focus on that part of her life because she was such an activist. You know, she was like Paul Robeson. You know, there were many people that claimed to be, but she was really the first celebrity activist who really, you know, helped and put herself on the line and dedicated her life and never really got the credit. I mean, for three decades, she was on the boards with the United Nations. She tried to end world hunger. She's been involved with the homeless community.
Oh my, yeah.
You know, early telethon for cerebral palsy way in the beginning. She was the honorary mayor of Sherman Oaks. She's, you know, been involved with UNICEF. She's even a songwriter, and she actually wrote a marriage equality song a couple years ago that's become quite the rage. So there's a movie in the works about her, actually, a documentary by filmmaker Roger C. Mimos, and it's called Marsha Hunt's Sweet Adversity. It's really about her career and her activism, and you know, the film is still in development, so it's not quite ready to show yet for the series. But because she's 97 and she's such an activist.
Yes.
And she also works for my father. In fact, that was that was the beginning of her blacklisting period, strangely enough. But I was moved to bestow the award on her. So she's going to be accepting her award, but it's going to be given annually to a celebrity activist with my series that's participated that I feel, or that the board feels, is the one for the year to be honored, who's really, you know, through film or through their activism, really trying to change the world. And so that's why it's called The Hunt for Humanity, named after her. It's really going to be a nice award, too. It's being designed as we speak. So, you know, you never know who the next recipient will be, but there will be somebody special presenting it. And it's been kind of kept as a surprise.
All right.
So that's all in one night.
Oh, that's an amazing night for sure, for people to check out for sure on April 10th. Wow. Yeah.
And we have an illustrious host committee that's just a lot of people are supporting it, like Ed Asner, Ed Bailey Jr., Sharon Stone, William H. Macy, Billy Bob Thornton. You know, the list is growing. We have new supporters for my series. There's been such a core group. You know, Lily Tomlin and all that. She's been so supportive. Obviously, Tippi Hedren, I mean, there's just so many, you know, I've had Cher and different people attend.
Oh, wow. But, do you expect
some
other people?
I'm trying to reach out to, you know, new people that haven't been there yet so that they can, you know, join on and really help build it into a global thing. So I'm really reaching out to a lot of young people, too.
Right.
So that they can know what happened in Bhopal and how they can help, and also so that they can learn about Marsha.
So are you expecting some surprise people that are going to attend that are celebrities?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Oh,
that's, people have to stay tuned for sure and find out via social media. Kat Kramer has all the different social media. Check her out and see all that's happening April 10th. I know something's coming up real soon for you on Thursday. Tell us specifically about that, Kat.
You know, I'm on the board of Los Angeles Women's Theater Festival and also on the Festival Gala Committee. And I debuted a bit of my show, my duet with Mick, through them last year at one of their, it's not the festival, but it's one of their events at the Actors Gang that they do every year where they develop new shows, new solo shows. And it's dedicated to the art of solo performance. We're a multicultural organization. But this is the 22nd anniversary, and on Thursday night, I was lucky to say that I nominated two very special ladies for, they're giving out five awards. It's called Celebrating Phenomenal Women. That's the theme. And Solo But Not Alone is actually the theme of the festival this year. But the festival runs March 26th through the 29th. And I'm more involved with the gala, which is Thursday night. And I'm going to be presenting Lainey Kazan with the Eternity Award. And I nominated her, as well as the late Elaine Stritch, for the posthumous Infinity Award. And we have, well, I was lucky to get George Chakiris, who is a good friend of Elaine Stritch, to accept. And he also donated part of his jewelry. You know, I don't know if very many people know, because he's an Academy Award winner and he's such an icon, but he designed jewelry, so he donated that for the silent auction raffle, and I have some memorabilia there. Lainey donated some things. And Chami Kurosawa, who made the Elaine Stritch documentary called Shoot Me, she donated a sign. She signed the DVD, and then there's a personal letter about Elaine. And they're also honoring Margaret Avery, Alice Twan, and Esperanza America. There's five different honorees.
Okay.
So it should be a really fun night. I'm looking forward to it.
Definitely, yeah. And I think that looking at some of these actresses and the amount of talent they had and what they were able to give to Hollywood, it's great to honor them and learn about them, right?
Since one is a playwright, the other ones are actresses, but they're all multicultural. I mean, we have Hispanic, or I guess Latina, African-American, Anglo, and Asian. So they're all different cultures, and the festival is very much about diversity. And for the first time, we have more women of color than ever in the festival, and there's a lot of people flying in from all over the world with their shows.
Yeah.
And also Ted Lang from The Love Boat, you know, who played Isaac on The Love Boat?
Yeah,
he's co-hosting with Frida Payne. But what I want to bring up about Ted is that, you know, I'm on Child of the 70s,
yes,
the web series in its third season. Well, I'm also not only a featured role in there, which is a pretty big part of season three, but I'm also now a producer on the show, and I was able to get Ted to play like a cameo. He shot that a couple weekends ago, and the great Judy Tenuta, who's so hilarious.
I've had her on my show. She's sweetheart, for sure.
I got her to play Michael Vaccaro as the lead, and he also created Child of the 70s. And she plays his mom. So I don't want to give away.
Well, that's going to be funny. For sure. That's going to be interesting for sure. Yeah, that's going to be great.
Well, we're launching season three. It's going to launch on April 29th. That's when it will be available, and there will be a premiere. So I'll definitely let you know there's going to be an actual, you know, screening premiere, red carpet party, that whole thing. So I'm really looking forward to that.
You got to be excited about being asked to be a producer, too. Last time you came on and you were just talking about you're going to be acting in it. Now we find out you're producing as well. So you're definitely putting your stamp into this one. And that's another unbelievable project for sure.
And there's so many people in it, like Susan Olsen. So that's, you know, from the Brady Bunch.
Yeah.
Bruce Valanche returns on this. And then Carol Ida White, she's an actress. But the interesting thing is her dad, Jesse White, I found out that was who her dad was. He worked with my father, I think, 3 times, and he also worked with my mom. And Bruce Hart is in it, and Walker. You know, there's different people in each season, but we have some of the core groups. So I don't want to leave anybody out, but I really am excited that it's my first web series, actually, except for my own that I'm putting together. But it's my first time acting in a project like this, and it's so full of, like, 70s cameos.
Definitely.
And I'm pretty sure season 4 is even going to have more.
Well, yeah, so we'll have to stay tuned. That's why Kat Kramer comes on once a month or every other month, depending on how busy both Kat and I are. But I said to Kat, just pick up the phone, call me, or just message me on Facebook, and you're on the show, and that's for sure. And we hope to have some of these people you've been talking about, specifically in all these different things, hopefully on the Total Celebrity Show. We'll see based on time and certain things, but Kat's the one that will be able to make that happen, because Kat is definitely... knows lots of people in Hollywood and really is a mover and shaker, to say the least. Now, when you talk about April 29th, I guess being asked to be a producer, what do you see in your memories of the 70s that kind of puts it into this web series? Especially,
well,
you,
I was born in the late 70s, and the lead character that Michael plays, Carlo, grew up in the 70s, and he ends up working for his childhood idol, who turns out to be a real diva, named Kiki Lawrence. That's played by Ann Walker. And but I play a real diva too, and I play 3 distinct characters. But you really have to see it, because I can't, you know,
right,
you have to see it unfold. But let's just say it's a soap opera based theme on season 3.
Can people
see? There's all different kinds of platforms you'll be able to see it on, besides YouTube, like Funny or Die, Lift.TV, OutTV, UBN, Gay Direct. There's probably some other platforms too about to be announced. And the director is amazing, Tom Pardo. He's just incredible. And he directed the whole season. So,
all right.
You know, sometimes you have a different director per webisode, but he did the whole season.
And then older seasons are already available online, correct? For season 1
and 2. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Season 1 and 2, yeah. And the producers of this web series, 2 of the main producers, actually produced Teach Your Children Well. So I thought I would get that in, because this is their first web series too, and it just happened to be that they produced that and they came on board. And so it's really definitely kind of a family thing when I think about it, you know.
And what do you think now of the whole ability now to go ahead and be on web series and stuff? It's because people are so easily able to find things online. It's sometimes even a better thing at times, because then you get to such talented people to work with, and specifically have projects that you never know might have not had all the funding available, now have the ability to get out there and have talented people bring a message and a fun show to the
and a lot of it was done on Kickstarter too, so you know that's another way of going. Well, I'm approached to be doing another web series, and then last night I went to this party at the Standard Hotel here in L.A. It was actually the kickoff for the Tribeca Film Festival, you know, in New York next month, so they always have an L.A. kickoff. And I ran into Tommy Wiseau, who I hadn't seen in maybe 5 years, and I kind of helped discover Tommy. I mean, he's a character in the industry, really. He's kind of like, dare I say it, the new Ed Wood. And his movie, The Room, has become like a real cult classic. He was even in Time magazine. He was on the cover of the LA Times. And I introduced him to so many people, and he has a new web series on Hulu called The Neighbors, not to be confused with the ABC show called The Neighbors. And so he asked me to be on that. He wrote a role for me, actually when it was first in development. And so we'll see what happens with that.
You're definitely back acting again, Kat.
My favorite web series of all, besides Child of the 70s, because I'm a part of it. But my other favorite web series is Web Therapy, of course, that Lily is on, and Lisa Kudrow, and all a great cast of special guests that they have all the time. And it would be my dream to be on the next season of that, you know, in a scene or something. Just, I happen to know the creators of it, and the main Dan Bukatinsky, who's an an Emmy-winning actor and producer.
Yes, yes, Dan.
And Don Roos, who directs. And they've had everyone from Meryl Streep to Billy Crystal on it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, definitely.
But Lily is a, you know, a regular because she plays Lisa Kudrow's mom, Fiona, as Lisa's character. So, yeah, I've been to all their events, and I support them. I visited the set, and I would, you know, I would love to be on that just once, just to have, like, a